to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, are your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little later in the show, we will be talking about some of the issues around felon disenfranchisement in the United States. We're also going to talk a little bit about nuclear disarmament around the world. And we are also wishing the producer of this show, Mr. Bob Schlehuber, a happy birthday. He does a great job putting the show together every day. But before we can move on, well, it didn't take long. 5 days into the new year, major internet providers like Comcast, Charter, and Cox filed with federal regulators a petition designed to make it easier for them to abuse information they collect about you when you use their internet services. Telecom companies and the tech world have also already previously weighed in favor of similar changes. The rules at issue are summarized by the Washington Post thusly. The rules require internet providers to obtain their customers' explicit consent before using or sharing sensitive data with third parties, such as marketing firms. That can mean dialog boxes, new websites with updated privacy policies, or other means of interaction with companies, which may offer discounts or other incentives to customers who voluntarily consent to online tracking. The rules also restrict trading in health data, financial information, social security numbers, and the content of emails and other digital messages. The rules force service providers to tell consumers what data they collect and why, as well as to take steps to notify customers of data breaches. So basically, the rules mean that they can't just sell all your information to everyone, no matter what. This is extraordinarily key because internet service providers, even more than Google and Facebook, are in a very unique position to see everything you do online. Now, as corporations search for profits, the internet has become the source of a mining frenzy. Facebook, Google, and yes, your internet service provider are all becoming mining companies. They mine your personal data for behaviors, trends, likes, dislikes, location data, search histories, online purchases, basically everything you do, then package it and sell it to advertisers, among others. Big internet service providers were hoping to get one up on the Facebooks and Googles of the world, given their more global view of user activity online, hoping to create a massively lucrative new business stream. And as many privacy advocates warned at the time, and what ultimately led to the rules being passed in the first place, is that all of this happens totally or essentially without your permission, and that the most personal data of users could be packaged and sold in millions of different ways without any consent from them really at all. And now, of course, with this new government we have in both the executive and legislative branches, internet service providers are seeking to bring their ideas for a new profit machine back to life. And given that the FCC will have a Republican majority again this year, seems likely that all systems are go for your most personal information to be sold to the highest bidder behind your back. A very disturbing video has emerged from Rollsville High School in Rollsville, North Carolina. In a 9-second clip, Officer Ruben De Los Santos, allegedly in the name of breaking up a fight, picks up one female teenager, lifts her almost over his head, and then slams her down to the ground so hard that she got a concussion. Something that is abundantly clear in the video when she's helped up and is clearly dazed and confused. It looked like a scene out of the NFL, certainly more so than a high school lunchroom. The fact that the officer is even trying to use the excuse of breaking up a fight, which, by the way, is disputed by witnesses, the type of takedown he used bears no resemblance at all to anything that could remotely be considered crowd control or situation calming. He essentially just came out of nowhere and used a pro wrestling move on her, except it was real, not fake. The abuse of power is shocking, but honestly, routine. We, of course, remember the officer in South Carolina who faced no charges at all after swinging a teenage girl around a classroom like a rag doll. We also remember the incident in McKinney, Texas, where a young black woman is slammed to the ground by a police officer for literally no reason at all. And that same officer who had recklessly escalated the situation, at one point even waving a gun around at a group of kids, also faced no legal consequences. Well, at least not yet, because that young woman is now suing the officer in the town for $5 million. Hopefully she wins. We also, as you remember, have reported many times on this show about the use of violent methods by school cops on children. For example, between 2006 and 2014, 199 kids were pepper sprayed in Birmingham schools, including the story that we've told you many times of the young woman who was pregnant, who was pepper sprayed in the face for crying. too loudly by a school police officer there in Birmingham. And also, in addition to the 199 kids pepper sprayed directly, over 1,000 were indirectly exposed to pepper spray in these incidents. And of course, there's also something we've reported on again on this show multiple times, a Huffington Post report that found that since 2011, 84 kids have been tasered by school cops, including crazy stories like someone being tased just for running away from the principal's office. There are over 17,000 school cops. They get a significant amount of federal aid, and clearly this has led to an increase in unnecessary and often brutal arrest. At a certain point, it has to be recognized that the police in this country are totally out of control and that they use a bevy of false and misleading statements and so-called facts to bolster the idea that this is the most dangerous job in America. It isn't. More taxi drivers die than cops every year, and that only good people are cops. But when you have a culture of total impunity for police crimes, this is what you get. Thugs giving teenagers concussions with wrestling moves for no reason. We talk a lot on this show about anti-black racism, and I wish that that was the only type of racism around, but sadly, as just about all non-white people in America can report, that is not the case. Many falsely portray Asians in an entirely monolithic way as a quote-unquote model minority, which is both a false assertion of universal prosperity, but also, and more importantly, a complete whitewash of the absurd racist assimilationist standards that immigrant groups are held to if they are to be quote-unquote acceptable, and the immense historical racism that's been placed on Asian people in this country over its existence. A couple of recent stories illustrate that despite being caricatured as the quote-unquote good minority, Asians in this country still face a tremendous amount of racism in our society. First and foremost, just look at TV and film, where easily the easiest ethnicity to mock and get away with are Asians. But again, let's go to some recent tangible examples. Seong-Won Chol, a Korean-American professor at the University of Illinois Chicago, has recently filed a lawsuit, this is the second time he's had to do that, against the school alleging outrageous behavior by administrators. At one point, Chol was told he had to teach a statistics class because, quote, Asians are good at math, end quote. And at another moment, he was asked to teach Korean history despite having no formal training in that subject in a college setting now because he was Korean. And in another, a grade he gave a student was changed, and when he asked the head of the department what happened, the explanation he was given was that he had to understand as a quote-unquote foreigner that Asians were stubborn and couldn't grasp the culture of compromise in America, which is also just a shocking way to give a grade, to compromise about the grade. I mean, either you got it or you didn't. Either way, there it is. And Chol, as I mentioned earlier, had already filed an EEOC complaint about this behavior in 2010. The school settled with him and actually promoted him, which is a pretty clear sign that the allegations he was making were true. Yet the racist behavior did not stop. He filed a second complaint in 2016 and received a right to sue notice. And here we are. And in case you were wondering, 18%, or roughly 5,200 students at UIC, are of Asian heritage. And there was also a video that emerged from Las Vegas, Nevada this morning that was from New Year's Eve. And the course of the video, it's so expletive laden here, it's shocking. You're going to have to go look for it. She comes out. She's got a Filipino neighbor. She confronts the guy. And in 90 seconds, manages to get all of this in. She called him an orange MF. That's a quote. Said that the Philippines was, quote, some piece of expletive Manila, expletive, expletive ghetto, living under a tarp piece of expletive land. You could probably fill in the blanks there. But wait, she wasn't done. In the 90 seconds, she also got in there that Filipinos were, in her view, quote, one generation out of the jungle like loincloth wearers, end quote. Local news reporters tracked this woman down. She said that it was a long time beef between her and her neighbor, and that her comments were, just get this, that her comments were not aimed at Filipino people generally. Wow. I don't know. She then did add, quote, I was completely wrong. Well, out of all that, at least she got one thing right. Well, the news of the day is the hearing that took place earlier in Congress regarding the Russian involvement in the elections. Obviously, we've talked about this quite a bit, and I hope that everyone listens to the interview we did yesterday with Mr. Jeffrey Carr, cybersecurity expert, around the claims themselves. But none of the specifics about what's happening matter at all to someone like John McCain, who we should remember was an enthusiastic participant in Vietnam-era bombing campaigns that killed millions of people. So not exactly exactly the moral arbiter that everyone is holding him up to be right now. And he's looking for this star turn here, pushing his pet issue of hatred of Russia. Remember the 2008 presidential campaign? He'd looked into Putin's eyes. The substance of the hearing was, you know, whatever, add basically nothing of what was already known. But one thing has to be noted about all of this. One of the people who testified, who's being quoted by the media as very authoritative, is James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence. But what the New York Times and, quite frankly, just about every other news source is refusing to actually put in this, in the context of Clapper testifying, is that he has already been caught once red-handed lying to Congress about NSA spying. So basically lying to Congress about almost the exact type of thing that he's testifying now and being considered an expert on. And the fact that every article about his testimony doesn't leave with, quote, proven perjurer James Clapper is just beyond me. The fact that his testimony is accepted so uncritically has been a hallmark of this entire thing. If the CIA says it, it must now be believed. And if you don't believe it, you're a traitor. Forget the fact that in literally the past decade, the CIA and NSA have lied consistently to Americans about spying on them and the extent of their torture regime during the Bush years. Remember, we're talking about hacking. The CIA actually proven, admittedly, hacked into Congress in order to try to cover up evidence of their own brutal torture schemes. Clapper and the NSA, as I just mentioned, straight out lied about what the NSA was doing and also created a whole false story about what this intelligence had wrought, saying that, oh, well, we had gotten all this, we'd stopped all these terrorists with all this stuff that we were doing, which also turned out to be false. Literally, the entire intelligence community has spent years trying to mislead people about more or less every single thing that they do. Yet now, many of the same media outlets that broke the stories about them lying and doing these things are failing to perform even the most basic level of journalism in terms of running these anonymous quotes without putting any of the context that's in their own publications in there for people now to get a sense of. And John McCain in general is a warmongering personality. Since 2008, obviously, this has been almost his sole mission to push America closer to war with Russia. And in fact, as you may remember, Barack Obama very ably ridiculed both McCain and then later Romney during the campaigns in 2008 and 2012 for basically this exact type of behavior. Yet now people who raised the exact same points as Obama against many of the same people are shouted down in the public square. Well, either way, no doubt this entire controversy will continue well into 2017. Let's hope that some people in the media wake up and start at least trying to do their jobs in terms of reporting this story. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And we are continuing our conversation. Well, we're switching gears here to start talking a little bit about non-proliferation issues in the nuclear weapons world. We are joined in studio here in Washington, D.C. by Lillian Daigle, the network campaigner for Global Zero. Lily, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Eugene.
No, of course. Well, it seems like this is lots of tension between the United States and Russia. They have 14,000 combined nuclear weapons. We're in a situation where nuclear tensions around the world really seem to be higher than they've ever been. I mean, how important is it moving forward that there's strong diplomacy in reducing nuclear arsenals around the world?
I think it's critical. You know, diplomacy rather than war is going to be our best way of reducing and ultimately eliminating nuclear weapons worldwide. I do think that the fact of the matter is that we're never going to get diplomacy until people hit the streets and start demanding that our politicians sit down at the negotiating table and start taking this issue more seriously.
Well, I think it's a good point, and I mentioned that you were with Global Zero. So I also wonder, I mean, in terms of your organizing strategy, how important is it to have sort of a movement without borders, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, it's critical. We, Global Zero and a handful of other anti-nuclear kind of nonprofits that are out there, we have the policy to get rid of nuclear weapons. It's not like it's a big mystery how to eliminate nuclear weapons. The missing piece of the puzzle is political will. We just will not get that in this country or in this world until citizens start organizing and we kind of rebuild the anti-nuclear movement.
Well, I think that's a good question. I mean, what do you think? What are some of the lines for rebuilding that movement? I mean, it seems like obviously now it's as critical as it's ever been. Obviously, historically, this has been a major issue that at different times has cropped up politically. I mean, what are some of the things you all are looking at in 2017 to help jumpstart the work?
Well, in less than 3 weeks, we're handing the nuclear codes over to Donald Trump.
Great news.
Super exciting, terrifying stuff. This is a man who has repeatedly asked why we can't use nuclear weapons. He suggested that South Korea and Saudi Arabia get nuclear weapons. He's refused to rule them out on Europe. Just a couple weeks ago on Twitter, he suggested—
Wait, using nuclear weapons on Europe?
He's refused publicly to rule out using nuclear weapons on Europe.
Oof.
Yeah.
I missed that one. Continue.
And then, boldly going where no president-elect has gone before, he has tweeted that we need to expand our nuclear arsenal. Mm. So I think he's given us a lot of fuel for the fire. And, you know, I think we're right on the brink of kind of the public realizing that the true threat that these weapons pose to not only folks here in the United States, but people all over the world.
Well, one of the things that we've heard from a lot of different people across a lot of different struggles is post-election, they've actually seen sort of unprecedented new interest. Have you also experienced something similar?
Yes, definitely. I think the thing that I find most exciting is that there's unprecedented organic interest popping up from folks not even related to our organization, which is really inspiring and hopeful.
No, I think that is certainly the case here. I mean, we just mentioned the whole issue of nuclear tensions being high, but I also just think is if there's sort of like a meta question here, which is, well, yes, but it's defined. There's so many we've seen. There's so many nuclear mistakes. Just like it can happen at any time. It can happen quicker and, you know, more quickly than anyone thinks. Like as long as there's nuclear weapons, it's sort of like a constant present danger, if you will.
Yes, absolutely. JFK called it the sword of Damocles, and that's very real. Really, at any moment, the United States and Russia both have 1,000-plus nuclear warheads on hair trigger alert, locked, loaded, and ready to be fired off at literally a moment's notice, which is ripe for accidental use. There's cyber attacks. There's intentional use, accident, madness, miscalculation. It's always a looming threat.
It is indeed. The great movie, this is not even a joke, but it's now it seems like it because it's so out of date, but The War Games, Matthew Broderick, 1984. You want to play a game? I don't know. People should watch that if you're too young to remember it. Very good. I actually had a sixth grade teacher that made us watch it four different times to stress the potential dangers. It was a math class of, don't ask me how he was tying it in, of nuclear war. But it's good there. Also the book With Enough Shovels by Robert Scheer from the 80s. I mean, it seems to me this is a very – the Trump administration is a very sort of Reagan-like feel where that was a big piece of what they were doing was sort of war fighting, tactical nuclear weapons, putting out all these ideas. So that's another sort of interesting book. But either way, we are going to take a break. We're going to be back with more with Lilianne Daigle from Global Zero talking about global nuclear disarmament efforts here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we are your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing to talk nuclear non-proliferation, disarmament, getting to Global Zero, if you will, with Lilianne Daigle of the organization Global Zero. Lily, thanks for staying with us here.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. So I want to just keep moving here. You know, one of the issues I'm interested in your take on it, you know, I know that I've attended some events that you guys have done and you've brought some folks over here who are survivors of the Hiroshima attacks and things of that nature. Great events, I thought. What's your take on this kind of back and forth now happening at the executive level between Abe going to Pearl Harbor and Obama going to Hiroshima? I mean, is this like a step forward in the non-proliferation thing or is it more of a... I mean, you know, we know how these politicians are, more of a diplomatic game.
You know, I would say it's more of a diplomatic game. I think when President Obama went to Hiroshima, which was definitely historic, and we're all very happy that he went, he didn't match that symbolic trip with any sort of substantive changes in U.S. nuclear weapons policy. So in my mind, you know, these trips are purely kind of like symbolic gestures of diplomacy.
And it's sort of like a withering on the vine for him, right? I mean, I don't know 100% about all the details. Maybe you can enlighten us. But when he first came in and, you know, he's working with Russia, they got the New START treaty. I mean, it seemed like he was going to try to prioritize this issue and kind of push it. And then now it's just whatever, you know, sort of floral moves.
Yeah. I mean, you know, at the bottom of his heart, I do believe that President Obama deeply cares about this issue. I mean, this is something he wrote his dissertation on in college. Mm. But I think at the end of the day, the president can only do so much if the rest of his government doesn't agree with him. Mm. So when the man is surrounded by military generals and diplomats and foreign policy experts that don't want him to declare no first use policy, for instance, there's only, you know, he can't get that much done.
I thought, wait, well, that's interesting. I thought America was committed to no first use. That's not the case.
No.
So the nuclear first strike policy is still the case.
Yes. We were all campaigning very hard for a long time to convince President Obama to declare no first use policy. And that has not happened.
Wow. Well, that's okay. Well, I could see. I mean, I certainly see it from their perspective, but that's certainly quite unfortunate. Well, I mean, wow. Well, it's interesting to sort of see that because I think that it speaks to, you know, what are the, where are the vectors going to be like? It seems to me the U.S. has the most nuclear weapons, right? So to some degree,
Russia does.
Excuse me?
Russia has more.
Okay. Well,
just a small amount.
Well, so there you go. So it seems like more or less those are sort of the two vectors where the most sort of energy would come from to change things. I mean, do you think that is the case, or is this one of those situations where sort of the grassroots, or not grassroots, but sort of the political context has to be changed more at the grassroots level before we can expect any sort of big player to really prioritize this?
You know, I think a lot of folks in the anti-nuclear field are hoping that Trump's administration will bring renewed and strengthened ties with Russia. My own personal perspective is that Trump does not care about what policy experts have to say, and that role and that power of convincing our elected officials to start taking steps towards reducing and eliminating global nuclear stockpiles is going to fall squarely on the shoulders of the people. I mean, it's our moral responsibility to organize and mobilize both here in the U.S. and around the world to force these elected officials to do something about it.
Well, we have a clip from Donald Trump that we're hoping that we could play here, sort of speaking to some of his alleged strategy, although I think we have to just have disclaimer every time we say Donald Trump's strategy since he says something different every other day. So let me just play this and then we'll get your thoughts on it, Lily.
So I want people to cut their arsenals before we cut our arsenals. You know, we like to cut and cut, and who you follow. And I know for a fact that when they say they're going to cut, they don't cut. We cut, they don't cut. So with me, it's the deal. I will tell you, I'm going to get other people to cut. We have to do something with nuclear.
Leanne Daigle, a network campaigner with Global Zero, your response to the president-elect's comments there. Possible, unpossible, impossible?
You know, I'm just sitting here with a smile on my face because I honestly don't think that makes much sense as a diplomatic strategy.
It also just actually doesn't seem to have anything to do with actual nuclear. Like, people have said they were going to cut and cut. I mean, that's not the issue is the momentum, not that it, like, never happens.
Right. I mean, the world has significantly reduced our nuclear arsenal since even the 80s. So we know that, you know, we know that there are mechanisms in there for people to play fair and square with each other.
And is your expectation here, because I think, well, before I get to this, I was going to talk about the nuclear modernization, but let me actually start here because I think what he's saying also speaks to another big issue is that the U.S. just has sort of a double standard type policy. Like if you're down with them, if you're Israel, if you're India, whoever, they're going to just do what they can do to shield you. And my personal belief is a lot of this Obama encouraging of Japan to become more warlike is sort of a wink and a nod to them towards the potentiality of America allowing them to gain a nuclear arsenal. But then if you're just like some other country that they don't like, then all of a sudden you can't have them. So it's not as if like there's blanket, we don't want anyone else to get them. It's just sort of like, yeah, it'd be great if they didn't, but if they like us, they can. I mean, it just sort of seems like it creates kind of a a global power imbalance that makes people think, well, okay, like, yeah, nuclear weapons are bad, but if the U.S. is just going to let their friends have them and not other people, how can we be calling for whatever?
Right. I mean, I think there is no question to the fact that nuclear weapons are essentially like a tool of hegemonic power for the U.S. I do also want to push back a little bit, though, because I do believe that the U.S.'s longstanding policy has been on non-proliferation and ensuring other countries don't acquire nuclear weapons. I hear you on the wink, wink, nod, nod, and I hope to God Donald Trump doesn't change that policy, but he has, again, publicly hinted that Japan, South Korea, Saudi Arabia should all get nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, South Korea certainly at least wants them. I think Saudi Arabia probably does too, but you know, Japan, I think the good thing about Japan is at least they have a very strong movement there of people against war and militarism, which I think also speaks to another question that's relevant to this. It just popped into my head is sort of because I think this is one of the other issues that I've seen recently is sort of like the quote unquote anti-nuclear movement is almost like a silo slightly outside of like kind of the military industrial complex piece. When historically, I mean, in the 80s and the March for Survival, CND in the UK in the 60s, it was sort of the leading edge of a broader movement against war, militarism, and so on and so forth. Kind of like, look how crazy we've gone with these nuclear weapons. Let's walk it back. Do you think that sort of that kind of approach is still warranted today?
I do believe that a cross-movement approach and one that takes into account issues of militarism and hegemony and other issues of social and environmental justice, I think all of those are incredibly critical for us to build a successful movement today. I agree with you that our movement's currently quite siloed, but we've been breaking out of those doors with the No Red Button campaign that Global Zero Action ran. And, you know, we're seeing other groups talk about this issue more and more.
Well, I think it's a good point. I mean, I don't think – and I think that, you know, sometimes people think that you're sort of forcing the ball here, but I don't think that's really the case. I mean, it just seems like there's so many connections. I mean, from the cost to the health effects of where, you know, old nuclear weapons and nuclear waste are stored to, I mean, any number of broader issues. Also, the health effects of people working around nuclear weapons, which is something that no one talks about. So it seems like the connections are just out there. I mean, it's just a question of making it happen.
Yep. It's absolutely true. It's a question of intentionally making it happen. I think it's very easy for us to sit in our DC bubble and think big picture about, you know, international social movements when the reality is that there are people living all across this country and the world who are living with very real effects of the nuclear weapons complex.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, very good point. Well, let me ask you this. I guess we're committed to this at this point. I think President Obama committed to it. I don't know if it's went through 100%, but rebuilding the entire U.S. nuclear arsenal, which could cost like $1 trillion over, I mean, that just sounds like the exact opposite of what Obama is saying we should be doing when he's at Hiroshima about this is a huge threat. We got to stop this. And then it's like, yeah, but let's just spend $1 trillion building all new stuff.
Yeah, you know what it's from? He essentially signed a deal with the devil to get the New START treaty passed through Congress without fully, I think, understanding that this modernization would A, trigger a new global arms race, and B, cost $1 trillion.
Wow. Well, I mean, and especially I haven't looked at the details. I mean, I know they're trying to do with like all the different elements of the triad, but they must just be coming up with crazy sounding things. I mean, for example, in the late 60s, they tried to come up with a nuclear bomb size of a suitcase that they could just like walk into places and just like detonate all of a sudden with like lower yields. And it just sort of seems like putting $1 trillion towards nuclear weapons, you go back to that, you know, and I hope you can speak to this sort of this fallacious concept that there's sort of a fully destructive way to fight a nuclear war. I mean, that's something that people have been pushing for years, but that it's not true.
Right. I think the newest weapon that they've come up with that really signals to some people wanting more quote unquote usable nuclear weapons is the new nuclear armed cruise missile. It's going to be designed so you can dial up or dial down its strength, and you know, our enemies that we're firing it on or people that we're firing it on won't know if it's nuclear armed or not until it hits, which significantly increases the chances of nuclear war.
Yeah.
The other fun one I found out about yesterday was that some of our new nuclear weapons are going to be connected to the internet.
Oh, because that is a great idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing important gets hacked, so. Like, yeah, it's proving to be a fascinating and terrifying process of watching a lot of these corporations just completely go at it against each other for these outrageously large contracts.
I'm glad you raised that issue because this is a question I have no idea. But who are the – because – and this is crazy that I can tell you like who builds the F-16 or whatever. Who are some of these companies making all this money off nuclear weapons?
Yeah. I'm not an expert on this, so I'm going to just say that before I name off some of these corporations. Mm-hmm. Are Lockheed Martin, mm-hmm. they're Boeing, they're General Dynamics, they're Raytheon. A lot of these same people that manufacture regular bombs, non-nuclear weapons, are also kind of trying to get in this business.
Well, it's obviously a growth industry vis-a-vis the Congress. So, are your expectations, what is the lay of the land in Congress? Some of these people have to, I don't know, maybe people are going to say I'm strikingly naive by saying this, but some of these people have to have a better position than let's just build more nuclear weapons. It can't be all doom and gloom.
Absolutely. We have some real champions in Congress. Senator Franken and Senator Markey are probably our two biggest ones. And I know Global Zero doesn't really do a lot of work on the Hill, but a lot of folks, including Women's Action for New Direction and a few other groups, do a lot of work on the Hill, working to make sure that we have some real allies in Congress who are sticking up for us and fighting for us.
Okay. Well, hey, that's decent news. Other big news that's coming in the government. Donald Trump is coming in as president in the inauguration day. All sorts of different groups are bringing their message that day for him to see. Will there be an anti-disarmament message, perhaps?
Yeah, there's going to be an anti-
or a pro-disarmament.
Anti-nuclear.
Yes.
Anti-nuclear contingent marching in the Women's March on the 21st. And there's also a group that, honestly, I don't know much about, is organizing a big anti-nuclear rally and protest at Franklin Square Park on the 19th from 2 to 8 p.m.
Progress being made. I was looking in the UK, as it were, the Shadow Labor Defense Secretary came out and said, don't worry, that our leader of this party is not for nuclear weapons. We will be for Trident if we are able to win the next general election, which may be in 2019. And, the sort of context around that for people who don't know is many of the unions that are very supportive of the Labor Party have a lot of workers who work in the defense industry, so they don't want to lose the jobs. How do you guys address that same issue where in a country where the defense industry is like 20 times as large as the UK?
To be frank, we haven't cracked that egg yet, but I do know that there is historical precedent for working very close with labor unions. The nuclear freeze movement in the 80s did a great job recruiting unions. Yeah.
We are not that far from Tacoma Park, Maryland. Isn't that the first nuclear freeze? Something like that, close to it.
Yeah, one of the first nuclear free zones.
It was hundreds of cities, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think people don't know a lot of this movement history. They haven't heard about that. Talk about that a little bit if you could.
Yeah, the nuclear freeze movement was one of the largest, if not the largest, social movement of its time in the late 70s to early 80s. The largest political gathering in U.S. history was around nuclear weapons. Over a million people gathered in Central Park. And the nuclear freeze movement did a great job localizing the fight. They brought home the fight of eliminating nuclear weapons to, their local city councils, their county councils, the state governments, passing a series of local resolutions calling on Congress to freeze any new nuclear arms buildup. And ultimately, a lot of people credit the freeze movement for getting Reagan to flip on his pro-nuclear stance and sit down in Reykjavik and nearly negotiate the end of nuclear weapons.
Indeed. This is a complete random aside, but since I like to give book reviews while we're in this segment here, I think it's the third, maybe the second installment of the guy who was like Margaret Thatcher's like body guy or whatever, one of her top aides, wrote a biography about her and talks about how irate they were when Reagan went to Reykjavik and said what they said because they were gearing up for like a big push on nuclear weapons in the UK. And then he was like, why don't we try to get rid of all of them? But it's an important lesson, I think, because obviously Ronald Reagan isn't like a progressive icon or anything like that. But still, regardless of everything else, with the right pressure, was forced to reconsider.
Right. I also think it goes to show that nuclear weapons are a political problem, not a partisan problem.
What do you mean by that?
I think at the end of the day, when people have the political will to take action, they will on nuclear weapons because it makes the most sense. I don't really see this as a Democrat or Republican issue. I see this as an issue that most of our politicians just don't have much of an opinion about.
Mm-hmm.
And once people hit the streets and really take kind of sustained mobilizations, you know, I think politicians, regardless of their party affiliation, start to care.
Well, and, you know, it also raises another issue to me is, you know, what do you think about the role the media is playing in even sort of like raising the issue up? I mean, I've always sort of felt that you don't get a lot of, I don't want to say that like it doesn't ever come up, but it just sort of seems like it's not really one of those, like there's people who are making money and who are really invested in nuclear weapons and they're like pushing it. I think large numbers of people probably think it's crazy, but since it's not like in the everyday conversation, everyone talking about it, blah, 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 you don't really see it. And then you just see sort of like the occasional piece, Obama goes to Hiroshima, you see a piece. Not a lot of follow-up or anything like that. So, I mean, do you think that part of the issue here is that almost in some degree, sort of in the post-Cold War period, we've been sort of falsely lulled into a sense of security about what's going on?
I think up until very recently, that is very true. Donald Trump in the last couple months has just said the wildest stuff about nuclear weapons, that it's almost been constantly in the news. So I think in a weird way, he's given us a little bit, you know, the one silver lining of Trump is that he is raising the issue of the dangers posed by nuclear weapons.
It is funny how that is happening. I said to someone the other day that like the one silver lining of Ben Carson being appointed to HUD is that at least people will now realize that HUD is important. Like a lot of things that people maybe didn't care about. And then like he sends out a tweet like, whoa, better care about this kind of deal. I mean, any hope in his cabinet for sage advice in there in his nuclear brain trust, I guess?
I don't know if he has a nuclear brain trust. But I will say, I don't personally hold this opinion, but there are folks in the non-proliferation field that have some hope. I personally don't think that he has given us any reason at all to trust that he'll do the right thing when it comes to this.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's the number one thing with Trump in general, right? Is that like he could tell you, Lily, you're the best person on earth. I'm going to give you $1 million tomorrow. And then the next day be like, Lily Ann Daigle's the worst person on the planet earth. And I'm suing her for $1 million. I mean, it's just like it's night and day, which I think with nuclear weapons is the problem. You can't have
very dangerous issue. I mean, I think a lot of people don't know this, but if Donald Trump, in a fit of irate rage, decided to launch a nuclear weapon, one, no one could legally stop him from doing that. And two, we have so many nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert that within 4 minutes of hitting the proverbial button, an ICBM would be racing off to God knows where, and you can't take that back.
That's for sure. Well, that was Lily Ann Daigle from Global Zero. Please check their efforts out. And we are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about felon disenfranchisement in the United States of America, and we are joined for this conversation by Nicole Porter, who is the Director of Advocacy at the Sentencing Project. Nicole, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, of course, of course. And so apropos to our discussion here today, President Obama released a law review article in his old law review, the Harvard Law Review, about criminal justice reform. One of the issues that came up in there were the 6 million folks who cannot vote because of a felony conviction that disenfranchised them. And more about that, he mentions half of them live in just 12 states. So nevertheless, this has been a big issue for President Obama, and he's sort of re-entering it. Raising it again here on the way out, I guess you could say, moving forward. So maybe just for our folks here listening at home or at work or in their car, wherever they may be, you could give us a sense of the scale of the problem and the issue here with felon disenfranchisement.
Well, you set it up nicely. Nationally, there are over 6 million people who are disenfranchised as a result of felony convictions, and that ranges by state. And there's an extreme spectrum. So in two states, Maine and Vermont, people who are incarcerated can actually vote. They never lose their right to vote with the felony conviction. But then, as you mentioned, there are states with very extreme policies where people lose their right to vote for life if they have a felony conviction, absent a gubernatorial action, either a pardon or some other effort. And that means that, you know, people in states like Florida and Virginia, states with the most extreme policies, that someone can, you know, commit a felony offense at age 19 and lose their right to vote for the rest of their lives. And in fact, we have heard from people who, you know, are very senior, and we tend to hear from people coming up to a presidential election that, you know, given their advanced age, that they've never been able to vote, and, you know, it's harmed them personally. You know, we never get into the specific details of their crimes of conviction, but these felony disqualifications from voting range among offense levels, and there are some people who commit very minor offenses who are disenfranchised in states with extreme policies like Virginia and Florida, and of course there are also people with very serious offenses who are disenfranchised in those states as well.
It's an interesting thing, as a Virginian, I certainly know how crazy that can be. I mean, I also wonder too, I mean, I can sort of assume the answer here, but I'll let you tell me. I mean, is this another area where we're seeing the racial disparities in the criminal justice system have a big knock-on effect in terms of reentry and what's happening in certain communities?
Oh, certainly. Because of contact with the system and the way the criminal justice system operates in the United States, these laws, felony disenfranchisement laws, have a disproportionate impact on communities of color, particularly African Americans at the state level. So in states like Florida and Virginia, there are high rates of disenfranchisement among the black electorate. In Florida, for example, more people with felony convictions are disenfranchised than in any other state. Black disenfranchisement rates exceed more than 20% of the adult black voting age population in that state. And there are similar rates of disenfranchisement in states like Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee. And earlier I mentioned that, you know, coming up to the election, we typically get contacted by directly impacted people who are harmed by these policies. And coming up to the 2012 election, I remember very starkly that a elderly gentleman from Tennessee called, and I took his phone call, and we talked about his disenfranchisement in that state and how he wanted to try to vote at least once before he passed. And so we just talked about ways to address felony disenfranchisement in the state of Tennessee and the movement that was happening nationally to improve the policy.
Wow, that's just an unbelievable story. And I wonder about that, too. Obviously, one of the challenges, I think, with quote-unquote criminal justice policy is this sort of state-by-state, local, state, federal hodgepodge. So is this something that can only really be dealt with state-by-state, or could you have, you know, like a motor voter law type situation for former felons where the Congress just passed a law that sort of changed eligibility in a universal way?
It's doubtful that it could be done in a universal way because the franchise is granted state by state as governed by the United States Constitution and how state jurisdictions govern who can vote. There have been attempts at the federal level to expand enfranchisement to people with felony convictions. And so not in the current Congress, since we just started a new Congress earlier this week, but in the most previous Congress that ended, there had been legislation introduced called the Democracy Restoration Act that would have expanded the vote to people with felony convictions across the country in a federal election. So that means that even people in Virginia or Kentucky would be able to vote in presidential elections if they had a felony conviction. Now, that legislation has been introduced for several Congresses and it gets mired in partisan politics. So the ability to move that legislation through the process had been difficult even during the Obama administration. And, you know, obviously with this new administration, it may continue to be challenging. That said, there are things that through the executive office through the office of the president that could be due to at least raise the issue around felony disenfranchisement so people living within states know their rights and know when they receive the franchise and particularly what the laws are in their state. So presidential or executive agencies operating under the authority of the president could make sure that information is up to date and is provided to people in the states, and that information is clear and easily accessible for everyone, regardless of education level, so that they have a complete understanding, a full understanding of what their voting rights are, particularly if they have a felony conviction, and making sure that that information is available where people are. So perhaps making that information available in, you know, driver's license agencies around the country or other offices where there's large swaths of the community that interact with, you know, government agencies is a way that the president's office can make sure that these laws and this information gets out to the people who need to know it.
Mm. And, you know, one of the things I'm always interested in when we talk about sort of any sort of criminal justice issue on this show, obviously we know in terms of sort of quote-unquote mass incarceration proper and the number of people in prison, the U.S. is something like an international pariah, I would say. I mean, same thing with the use of solitary confinement, the use of the death penalty. I mean, where is the United States, I mean, especially I think compared to other quote-unquote industrialized countries in terms of this type of disenfranchisement of people coming out of prison?
Well, the United States has the highest rate of disenfranchisement. Well, I'm sorry, the highest rate of incarceration in the world. We have 5% of the world's general population and close to a quarter of the world's prison population. Other Western industrialized nations that the United States likes to consider itself in the same category as do not disenfranchise people who are incarcerated, and those people never lose the right to vote. You know, losing the right to vote is a very severe sanction and is the most representative act of sort of breaking the social contract between the individual and the state, the individual and government. And other Western democracies have decided that they simply don't do that. And so the fact that the United States does disenfranchise a large number of its electorate due to these felony disenfranchisement policies and the historical precedent for that interacts with our racial hierarchy in this country, and we can get into the weeds on that in terms of the history and how that plays out along racial lines. But, you know, other Western democracies do not disenfranchise people with felony convictions. And so the United States is certainly an outlier in that regard.
Well, I think that's always very interesting, but I'm glad you brought that up. I'm certainly curious about that as well. I mean, what is the history of this policy? I mean, I know a lot of these policies date back to sort of the Reconstruction, Redemption era when we talk about some of the worst pieces in criminal justice. Some of it's more things that happened in the 80s. You know, what's the little bit of a historical background here?
Those two historical events that you just mentioned are a part of the story, but it is also important to recognize that felony disenfranchisement starts sort of with the founding of the country, and settlers, people, you know, colonialists who settled this country brought over the policy or practice of a social death from their European countries of origin. And so the roots of sort of a break with the social contract date back centuries, and, you know, the original settlers brought that concept over with them. How that concept evolved in the United States is also a story of race, particularly given the racial hierarchy that is so rooted in the original development of the American idea, starting with slavery and the racial caste system that developed even post-slavery through Reconstruction and through Jim Crow. If you look at the constitutional histories of states with large numbers of disenfranchised populations, states like Virginia, states like Alabama, states in the old Confederacy, the constitutional record is clear that political elites, white elites at the time, carved out disenfranchisement disqualifying offenses specifically to exclude black residents from voting in state electoral contests so that they could participate in who represented them and who governed them. You can specifically look at Alabama, that in that state, there are felony offenses that are excluded from the vote that are carved out in that state's constitution called crimes of moral turpitude. And those crimes of moral turpitude specify by offense. And the offenses that are specified were offenses assumed to be likely to be committed by black residents. So you have the offense of wife beating that is a disqualifying voting offense in the state of Alabama, but the crime of homicide is not a disqualifying voting offense in the state of Alabama. So while the history of felony disenfranchisement was brought over by colonial settlers, the way it emerged, the way it evolved, was certainly an issue of race, particularly given the racial caste system that we have in the United States.
Well, and my hope here for my next question is that it's not all bad news. Have we seen any positive movements in different states rolling back disenfranchisement anytime in the, I guess, recent past?
There have been efforts to reform these policies. So starting in the late 90s, when the issue around felony disenfranchisement became more well known and this research became more a part of the public conversation, including the estimated number of people who were disenfranchised, states have worked to reform their policy. And again, most of the reforms are going to happen within states. So since 1997, 23 states have enacted reforms, and that includes states like Texas, which expanded the franchise to people who are off paper, who completed their sentence, the people living in the community who had completed their terms of parole or felony probation or who exited prison without any form of supervision. You have states like Rhode Island and Maryland also expanding the franchise to people in the community. Most recently, Maryland expanded the vote to people living in the community who are on felony probation and parole. And so that was some 40,000 people in the state of Maryland who were allowed to vote in the most recent presidential election because of changes in the state legislature. And those are state law changes that had to work their way through the legislative process, but there are have also been efforts by governors within states to expand the franchise to persons with felony convictions. So most recently, the governor of Virginia has been issuing executive orders individually restoring the right to vote to people in Virginia with felony convictions who meet certain qualifications. And the last I saw, there are some 70,000 people in the state of Virginia who had gotten their voting rights back as a result of gubernatorial action. And in other states like Kentucky, there have also been executive orders to expand the vote to people with felony convictions as well.
Mm. Well, that's good news. So it's good that there is at least some good news there. I mean, given that the obligatory question. I mean, given that this is more of a state by state type of deal, maybe it's not that big of a deal. But I mean, are you looking at any sort of net positive or negative change on this issue with President Trump coming in, or given sort of the diffuse nature of it, too difficult to tell how a president can affect that?
Well, I think there will continue to need to be grassroots conversations around expanding the vote. People who are directly impacted by these policies can elevate the conversation by emphasizing how not being able to participate in the franchise impacts their ability to participate in their community, to move on, and to support rehabilitative efforts for them in civic participation and other efforts around public safety. How things might change in the White House, given the new administration, I think, you know, we don't know. But I think that at this point, given the enthusiasm and the grassroots conversations that have been happening even before this most recent presidential election, that, you know, we here at the Sentencing Project and our colleagues and the directly impacted people who are doing wonderful organizing around the country amongst people who are directly impacted by these policies, that those conversations need to happen, and that, you know, hopefully these policies can continue to improve, if not expand the franchise to people who might even be incarcerated. So I know that this year there will be legislation introduced in states like Nebraska, Hawaii, and I've heard from people in states like New Jersey and Arizona who are interested in organizing campaigns and supporting conversations that expand the franchise to individuals in those states. And the policy goals, the organizing goals range, but I know that people are even looking at trying to expand the franchise to people who are incarcerated. So these conversations are happening and they'll continue to happen even given this new administration that, you know, is going to enter into the White House in a couple of weeks. And so there's still optimism and hope around what might be possible going forward.
We got about 2.5 minutes left, but I wanted to ask you one this question here, final question. In Congress, are you expecting any continuation of the, it's fairly bipartisan effort around sentencing reform issues, mandatory minimums, and the like moving forward in this next period?
Well, I certainly think there's possibility around that. Just earlier this week, Senator Grassley, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, was publicly quoted saying that he's committed to reintroducing sentencing reform in this Congress, and other U.S. senators, Republicans and Democrats, affirmed their support in continuing the conversation that had started in the last Congress. I think time will tell in terms of how the House of Representatives picks up the issue or even what the administration does as the Senate reintroduces legislation next week when Senator Sessions goes before House Judiciary for the confirmation hearing around his appointment to the Attorney General. These questions will come up, and your listeners and people who are following this issue might be mindful to weigh in and to listen in to see where the conversation is on next steps for sentencing reform on the Hill.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, I certainly hope it continues. And I guess the good thing is in the past few years, we picked up some Republicans on this issue. That was Nicole Porter, who's the Director of Advocacy at the Sentencing Project. Go to sentencingproject.org to learn more. They have a lot of fantastic reports that really go even deeper into depth on all of these issues to help folks who do want to say something or want to advocate in any way, whether it's in a confirmation hearing or in your local city council. I can promise you the work of the Sentencing Project will help you. So, Nicole, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.